So that's why I haven't read it. I got to do something so that he'd see it.
The House Committee on Transportation Economic Development will come to order.
I'm sure you respond to it.
Colleagues, we are going to be losing one of our members to redistricting, I think it is.
No.
No, Ways and Means.
Yeah.
In about 45 minutes, so we'll try to move through fairly quickly. And with that, I'm going to, I think it's reopen or open a work session on Senate Bill 130. Zach.
Senate Bill 130 is the bicycle traffic lights. Adds green, yellow flashing, and red bicycle signals to the list of traffic control devices.
And Mr. Chair, just to add to that, we also adopted an amendment, as you'll remember on Wednesday, that clarifies how to deal with flashing yellow arrows.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And before we go into this, I see we have a senator here.
She's we know here on Senate Bill 479, I believe.
479. Hmm. Maybe, I don't hate to have her wait, so why don't we going to close the work session on Senate Bill 130 and open the work session on Senate Bill,
public hearing
on Senate Bill 479. Zach.
Senate Bill 479 requires application for driver's license to contain information about whether or not an applicant wants to make an anatomical gift.
Senator.
Mr. Co-Chair, I have my constituents with me. Is it all right if they come up with me?
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Benz, Co-Chair Reed, committee members. I'm Suzanne Bonamici from Senate District 17, and I bring you Senate Bill 479 today. This is a bill that is designed to increase the number of organ donors and organ donations in Oregon and therefore save lives. According to Donate Life Northwest, 18 people a day will die waiting for an organ transplant, and there's more than 105,000 people in the United States waiting for a transplant. More than 2,500 of those are in the Pacific Northwest. I wanted to let you know that this bill, that is the purpose of this bill is to increase organ donations, and I'm submitting written testimony because I wanted to clarify an issue that came up in the Senate. This issue came to my attention through my constituents, Rex Bressel and Eleanor Golay, who are here with me, and they're going to talk about the need for increased number of organ donors. And when we started talking about the issue, I'd read a book, Nudge, which some of you may have read. I see Co-Chair Reed shaking his head. Nudge, Improving Decisions about Health, Wealth, and Happiness by economist Richard Thaler and legal scholar Professor Cass Sunstein. There's a chapter in that book called How to Increase Organ Donations. And when I read that chapter, there was a discussion about mandated choice, where you could increase the number of organ donors by requiring people to state when they applied for their driver's license or for a renewal, require them to answer whether they want to be an organ donor. That approach does not require somebody to say yes, but it would require them to make a choice. And in the hearing in the Senate, I was asked if that would require someone to actually make a decision to get a driver's license, and I was answered in the affirmative, and that's the interpretation that I presented in the Senate committee and on the Senate floor, that someone would have to answer the question, yes or no. After Senate Bill 479 passed the Senate, I learned that both ODOT and Donate Life Northwest were interpreting the bill to require that license applicants be asked the question, but that they not need to answer it. And it is my understanding that Donate Life would find problematic the interpretation that forced someone to answer the question because that may increase the number of people who checked no. Apparently, there was some confusion because people didn't know that the application had both a yes box and a no box, and in fact, it has both. So I want to submit this written testimony to clarify that as the sponsor of the bill, I'm in agreement with the interpretation that requires this bill, by this bill, to have all applicants asked if they want to be an organ donor, but not to require an answer. So again, just to clarify for the record, in case any court someday is looking at this, I'm going to clarify my intent as the sponsor of this bill that this will require everyone applying for or a driver's license or renewing a driver's license to be asked the question, do you want to be an organ donor, but they do not have to answer the question. That interpretation is still, we expect, going to increase the number of organ donors by assuring that everyone considers this very important issue when applying for or renewing a license. So thank you very much, Co-Chair Bence and Co-Chair Reed, for scheduling this today and for allowing me to clarify the interpretation of this bill by both ODOT and Donate Life Northwest, which I agree with, and hope that you will consider this and move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but you might want to hear from the constituents who brought this issue to my attention first. Thank you,
Senator.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bence, Co-Chair Reed, committee members. Thank you for this opportunity for me to talk about a life and death issue.
And forgive me for interrupting. Your name?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Rex Brazel. Do you want the address and all that?
Nope.
Oh, okay. Brasell. I would not be here today if I were not a recipient of a kidney donation. I'm one of the lucky ones. My wife was able to give me a kidney. Hundreds of other Oregonians don't have a living donor to save their lives or are on waiting lists for a kidney. The kidneys they're waiting for, if they come in time, will come mostly from accident victims who have signed an authorization on their driver's license application saying that upon their death, they're willing to donate their organs. If anything can be done to increase the number of donors, many lives will be saved. And I think we would all feel better about ourselves if we played a part in accomplishing this. I urge you to support Senate Bill 479 because I believe that more people will donate their organs if they think about it more when they get a driver's license. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Okay. My name is Eleanor Galle. I'm his wife. Co-chairs Bence and Reed and members of the committee, I want to offer my support for Senate Bill 479, introduced by Senator Bonamici. My husband Rex and I asked her to look into ways to improve upon Oregon's current organ donation program. This bill is the result of considerable research on her part into the best way to achieve what we asked her to do, and we are very pleased. I look at this issue from several perspectives. First, I am the wife of someone who had end-stage kidney disease and needed dialysis until he received a kidney. Second, I am a donor, since we were extremely fortunate and I was both a match and healthy enough to donate one of my kidneys to my husband. And finally, I speak as someone who ran Medicaid, ran the state health planning division, and was involved in several health care cost containment and reform efforts in New Mexico in the early 1980s. This latter experience helps me to see my personal experiences in a somewhat broader context than might otherwise be the case. According to the Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network of the U.S. Health and Human Services Department, as of February 25, 2011, there were 763 people on a wait list for an organ in Oregon, and more than half of them have been waiting more than 2 years, some for as long as more than 5 years. Clearly, this situation is creating great hardship, and I believe we can do better. Having worked in public policy for many years, I know that it is often helpful to have things put into law that are being handled administratively, as is the case with the organ donation option on the state driver's license form. This bill will, I believe, accomplish three things: increase the number of people who agree to be organ donors, help families make the difficult decision about whether or not to donate their loved one's organs by providing them with a clear preference, and it will ensure that current administrative policies are continued in the future. As with so many other people, kidney disease and organ donation was a mere abstraction until about 2 years ago when we learned that Rex's kidneys were failing. On March 1st of this year, we celebrated the one-year anniversary of our surgeries. Rex woke up from surgery and felt better than he had in months. We have our lives back. We recently returned from a three-month journey around the world. It was a celebrate life trip, one that we could not have taken without the transplant. On March 3rd, we had the one-year anniversary appointment with the transplant clinic. We've been looking forward to this. The physicians kept telling us that they love these appointments because the patients whom they first met when they were terribly sick are now, like us, getting on with their lives. Rex's nephrologist told us that if it weren't for transplants, he simply could not do his job because there would otherwise be so little hope for the patients that he sees. Donated organs not only transform the lives of the individuals who receive them, but the lives of their families. I have gone from being Rex's caretaker to being, once again, his partner. We've become friends with other organ transplant recipients and are continually amazed at the way they and their families also embrace their new gift of life, going back to work, supporting their family, traveling, volunteering to help the community, that is, leading full, rich lives again. Although we were fortunate and I was able to provide a living donation, only about a third of all donors are living. The rest are from deceased donors, the result of someone who specified they want to be a donor and a family that understood this and honored their wishes. If this bill results in the addition of only one more set of organs that save the lives of only one person, it would, in my opinion, be well worth it. If it helps one additional family make the anguishing decision to donate their loved one's organs, knowing that they are following that person's wishes, it would be worth it. According to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, one donor saves up to 8 lives. I believe this bill will save more lives than that. Rex and I are believers in the political process and have been active politically and with public policy most of our lives. For that reason, our response to our experience has been to see if there was some way we could help increase the supply of organs so others could enjoy similar benefits. We were fortunate to meet and be able to discuss our concerns with Senator Bonamici, who has done a wonderful job, we believe, in crafting this bill. We are grateful for the opportunity to testify before you today and for your consideration of this bill. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Whitener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to make sure I got this right. You were the donor for your husband for his kidney transplant.
The odds of that happening
are
1 in 2.
1 in 3. We have 3 up there.
It's fairly unusual for a spouse to be able to do it. I believe that in Oregon, we were at Good Sam. We went through Good Sam. There are 2 transplant clinics here, Good Sam in the state, Good Sam and OHSU. And I believe that something like 15 in the past year were, I don't know exactly how many were living donors. But it's pretty unusual. I mean, we had to be a match. At 65,
we're
I had
meant to
be
together. That's all I got out of this was you two were meant to be together.
We were very, very lucky. And, people are always saying, oh, my goodness, how generous. And my response is, no, this was a really selfish gesture on my part. If you can save a loved one's life, you do it.
Yeah. And then follow up for the good senator. Department, everything's happy, they're joyful with this. I mean,
somebody from the department is here, and we've been working with them, particularly since the question arose about the differences in interpretation. I'm sure somebody from the department would be welcome to answer questions if you have them. They currently have the question on the application and renewal form. This will just assure that everyone who comes in is asked the question.
Okay. As I said.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say on the record, to the extent it helps it make it even a bit more crystal clear that I support this bill, and my support of it is with my reading of the plain language of the statute and certainly my understanding of the intent. The bill would require that the question be asked, but that it not need be answered, but that the question, yes, be asked.
Co-Chair Bence, Co-Chair Reed, and Representative Smith, that is correct. And the reason I wanted to clarify that for the record is that is different from the testimony in the Senate committee and on the Senate floor when my position or my interpretation of the bill was based on what I had read in the Nudge book, and that is that everyone be required to answer the question. And the confusion came because some people thought that, as I explained, there was only a yes box. But it's problematic to build a list of no people, and that's what might have happened, because people who couldn't decide would probably just say, well, I can't decide, so I'm going to check no. And so I believe in the bill with the interpretation that the question should be asked of everyone who applies for a license or for a renewal, and I believe that that interpretation will also build the list of organ donors in a positive way. So thank you, Representative, for that
question. And thank you, Mr. Chair, very quick.
Follow-up?
Not a question, but just to say, I might support the bill either way. I'm merely wanting to add to the legislative record, and courts, if you're listening, we mean it, just so we don't have to mess with amendments if you don't want to.
And Co-Chair Benz and Co-Chair Reed and committee members, I don't want to speak for all my other colleagues on the floor, but there were a few no votes, which I believe were probably based on the requirement that the person be forced to answer the question. That was a concern that was raised. Some people just didn't want somebody to have to answer the question. So I just bring that up, not wanting to speak for my colleagues, but it's my understanding that some of the opposition was from the interpretation that I'm now submitting. I don't support for this bill.
Further questions? Just had a couple. Other states' position, what are other states doing?
Co-Chair Benz, it's my understanding that other states do similar things to try to build organ donations. I want to thank the Department of Motor Vehicles here in Oregon, because it's my understanding they've been ahead on some of these issues of other states. It is typical for organ donations to be indicated on a driver's license, and in fact, it's an interesting issue, and I bring it up only as something to think about, that the question doesn't say, do you want to be an organ donor? The question says, do you want your driver's license to show that you are an organ donor? So that's been something that has been part of the driver's license process for I believe, quite a long time. And it is a typical place for that choice to be indicated in Oregon as well as in other states.
Mm-hmm. I was just looking at the language, and it says the application must contain all of the following, and then the new language is whether or not the applicant wants to make a gift. If a person chose not to answer, then the department has said what? I think you may have mentioned this earlier.
Co-Chair Benz, it's under the interpretation of this bill that I support, and it's my understanding the Department of Motor Vehicles and Donate Life Northwest supports, is that the person would not have to answer the question in order to get the driver's license, but they would have to be asked the question. But they would not have to answer.
Right.
Did I answer your question?
Right. I actually was wondering if we will have someone from the department come up and state that the department interprets it the way you do.
We need
to hear that from them, because if they don't, we need to make that clear, because that would seem to remove pretty much all of the – what other objections could somebody have? And that would be, my next last question.
Co-Chair Benz, I appreciate that. I don't know what other objections people would have. I know there was a question raised on the floor about – someone who's underage, because you can get a driver's license before you're 18, obviously. And it's my understanding that someone who is under the age of 18 can indicate on his or her driver's license the choice to be an organ donor, but cannot actually donate without parental consent. So in case anyone's wondering, that was a question that was raised. I don't know that it's an objection. But the indication can be made by someone who's under the age of 18, but in order to actually be a donor under the age of 18 would require consent.
Right. Yes,
Mr. Chair, it seems also implicit, but maybe we're saying explicitly, if I heard correctly, that if someone has asked the question and declines to answer, that the interpretation then is that that's effectively the same as saying no, that there would not be a donation made if there's no affirmative answer. Is that right?
Co-Chair Benz and Co-Chair Reed, if someone is asked the question and can't decide, they can say, I can't decide, and then the boxes, the yes box and the no box, will both be left blank. That is my understanding.
Indeed. And follow-up, Mr. Chair, in that case, a person who has gone that route dies. There's no, the assumption is no donation. Is that
Co-Chair
right?
Benson, Co-Chair Reed, I don't know the answer to that question. I believe that it may have to do with, I believe that in that circumstance, the family may have some say if the no box is not checked, but I don't know that for a fact, and I don't know if anyone from Donate Life is here.
Okay.
but they were concerned about having a no-box check. Donate Life Northwest was concerned about having a no-box checked if the person couldn't decide. So I believe, co-chairs, that there is more possibility without a box checked for someone who can't decide, but I can't answer that definitively because I don't know the law in that area.
So just a comment then. It sounds like there's other considerations that would come after that, but the absence of a check would not allow someone to interpret that to be an affirmative.
Or vice versa.
Right.
I guess the challenge is to make sure the document, that the questions don't prompt a negative outcome, which might not otherwise be the case. So the question then would become, do we need a third box that says, I don't choose the answer to the question, I haven't made up my mind, or I don't know what I want to do, or someday I'll answer it. In other words, something that wouldn't foreclose the possibility of the relatives then going ahead and making the gift if they chose to do so, should there have been nothing said on the driver's license.
Co-chair Benz and committee, interestingly, we were just talking about that before we came down here, and I'm committed to continue to work on that if we believe that would be helpful. It might be helpful to hear from the department about how they plan to assure compliance that the question has been asked in each instance.
Right. Further questions? Thank you very much. Well, the department come up. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
And who do we have from the department?
Chair Benz, Chair Reed, members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, happy to be here today. I guess what I could start out with is that the current form does offer a yes or no checkbox. Current practice, clerks in the office are supposed to answer this question, but we can't guarantee that it's happening all the time. So under the bill, clerks would be required to ask that question, but no response would be necessary. So if someone simply declined to check a box, they would not be denied a driver license. So that's the status that we understand it to be today under the bill.
And are there rules that say this? How do you tell your offices what you just told us? Is that in your administrative rules? Where would we see what you just said in writing?
Chair Benz, that would be in a procedure manual. I don't believe it to be an administrative rule, but rather a sort of a desk manual for a clerk at a DMV customer counter. Mm-hmm. It's also prompted on the computer screen. So there's a entry on the computer screen, and that prompts a clerk to ask the question. And then if the person checks yes, then that would be indicated.
So make sure I understand, is if we adopt this law, what would change?
Chair Benz, some of our application forms would be updated. There are some forms that don't currently contain the question. And in addition, it would be a mandatory part of the process to ensure that that question is asked every time.
And when you say to ensure it's asked, you mean it's not a verbal exchange, it's simply a document someone has to fill out?
Chair Benz, a verbal exchange. Today, to get a driver license or to renew your driver license, that is now an in-person transaction. There is no more renewal by mail, except for some very rare, very particular circumstances for folks who are, for instance, out of the country for an extended period of time.
So someone would be asked this question?
Chair Benz, that's correct.
Yeah. Further questions for Amy? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Colleagues, I think we are ready to work this bill. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 479 and open a work session on Senate Bill 479.
Co-chair. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 479 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Co-chair Reed has moved Senate Bill 479 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And do we have a carrier? Do you want to carry? Co-chair Reed will carry. Thank you very much. And with that, we'll go back to Senate Bill, let's see, 130, reopen the work session on Senate Bill 130 and the DMV. I'm sorry, ODOT. Who do we have? Somebody.
Anyone who's left in credit to do, Mr.
That's
Chair.
Okay, colleagues, as you may recall, we were discussing green, yellow, and red bicycle signals. Is that right, Zach? Are we on the right bill?
And blinking yellow.
And blinking, that's correct, as amended. And the question I had is what benefits accrue to automobile drivers as a result of this so-called bicycle bill?
Chair Benz, member of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. First, I just want to clarify, before I answer that question, just clarify in the bill that this bill does not permit or allow the signals to be put in place. What the bill does is put the signals in statute to allow officers to enforce this with a violation. If the bicyclists do violate the signal, it would be a Class B traffic violation with a fine of $287 for the bicyclist. But to answer your question, Mr. Chair, specifically, the benefits, I believe, for the drivers as well as the cyclists would be a more predictability in intersections. When bicycles and drivers are combined in the same lane, there's often confusion and oftentimes a safety issue when those movements are combined with turning movements from that same lane. By having a separated, dedicated signal for bicyclists, we're able to stop the cyclists and allow the motorists to move through the intersection without worrying about what the cyclists may or may not be doing as they travel through the intersection. Of course, vice versa, stop the motorists and allow the cyclists to move through without concern for motor vehicle traffic through the intersection. So in short, it's predictability as well as allowing for enforcement of the bicycle signals that are out there today and will likely continue to grow.
Questions? Just a couple. The current arrangement, if I understand it correctly, without the signal, is that you have cars and bicycles waiting for the light to change. The light changes, the bicycles take off from their bicycle lane, which generally is over on the right.
Correct.
And automobiles that want to turn to the right on green find that they have to wait for the bicycles to zoom through first. Is that what's happening now?
They, Mr. Chair, that's correct. They'd have to yield to the bicyclists as they travel through straight before they executed the right turn. With the signals, we would stop the bicyclists, allow the motor vehicles to make their right turn without, again, worrying about the movements of the bicyclists.
So but to compare the current situation to where we would hope these signals would lead is to, I hope, illustrate how much less challenging life would be for the automobile driver. That's what I'm trying to understand. So whoever's driving the automobile does not have to be quite as concerned about turning to the right because the bicycles would be stopped waiting.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. This bill would simplify it for the motorists greatly in that typically the way the bicycle signal is designed, they can't even see the signal heads on the bicyclist's seat. And all they have to do is follow the signal in front of them and proceed with the movements that are allowed by that signal and not worry about the movements of a bicyclist.
And from a timing standpoint of moving the bicycles across the road by themselves and the cars turning by themselves, the concept is that we would actually save time by not having the muddled situation we now enjoy. That's the thought.
Mr. Chair, that's correct, and that would also often go into the decision-making process of when to put these signals, bicycle signals in place or not, is when you were able to make the intersection operate more, not only more safely, but also more efficiently. So it wouldn't go in every signal intersection. That would be one of the criteria of when you would place a bicycle signal at an intersection or not.
Thank you. That answers my questions. Any questions? See none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Zach, are we ready to work this bill?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 130 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Reed has moved Senate Bill 130 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you.
Is there discussion? Seeing none, is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And the question is, who would like to carry? Who's from a place with lots of bicycles? Mr. White, what are you going to want to carry?
I love bicycles.
Mr. White, you're going to be the carrier. Thank you very much. Okay.
Do you think there's someone better than me to carry this note?
I can't.
Can I, Mr. Chair, can I enter this note and into the record?
Carmen
Nix.
I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 130 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 133.
Senate Bill 133 exempts a person applying for a restricted motorcycle endorsement to operate a motorcycle with more than two wheels from requirement to take the motorcycle rider education course.
We have. Thank you. Okay, we have. That's not somebody. Okay, Van Moore, Pat Hahn, and that's it.
I think that's somebody.
Sorry. And quiet. Three. Come on up. Who'd like to go first?
I'll step out. Co-Chair Benz, Co-Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Van Moore. I'm a resident of Salem, Oregon, 24 years. And I'm here on behalf of the, in my capacity as the Vice Chair of the Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety. As many of you are probably aware, that committee has been in place since the mid-80s and was formed to be a voice for motorcyclists in the state of Oregon and consulting with our governor in issues relating to motorcycles, specifically those of motorcycle safety. To fully understand why Senate Bill 133 was put forth, it's important to understand Senate Bill 546 that was written into law and signed in 2009. 546 was a bill that increased the mandate of education for new endorsees for motorcycle endorsement from just the 21 or under 21 group to ultimately over a five-year period beginning in January of this year with 30 and under and progressing up to all riders, all new endorsees, it's more appropriate to say, by 2015. The bill was put in place as a furthering the step of furthering Oregon, I should say, really as our preeminent nation's preeminent state for motorcycle safety. We are recognized nationwide as a leader in motorcycle safety and training. Our motorcycle deaths dropped last year to, I believe it was 38. I could be misspeaking there, but I think that's correct. Phenomenal gains that we have made in motorcycle safety. As the training requirement was developed starting in the mid-80s, a lot of it was originally driven by the Hurt Report, which was released in 1981. It was the nation's seminal report on accidents with motorcycles. It was done in Southern California. Over 3,600 accidents were examined. And those accidents were found to be 75% multi-vehicle accidents, usually with a car turning in front of a motorcycle, a car pulling out in front of a motorcycle. As Team Oregon, which was developed in, I think, 1984, as they began developing their curriculum and training, they found that this was not necessarily the case in Oregon, and current statistics will bear that out. Current statistics maintained by the Oregon Department of Transportation and the motorcycle safety group there show that over 70% of our accidents here in this state are single vehicle accidents, 70% of our deaths on motorcycles, I should say. Most of those are individuals missing a corner, what we commonly refer to target fixation. And as they have evolved their training to address these issues, they found that they needed to focus on the unique handling characteristics of a single-track two-wheel vehicle. It handles like nothing else, like no other vehicle. And by doing that, we have caused this huge decrease in motorcycle deaths, especially among our young people, those that are 20 and under. Those statistics have really improved. Senate Bill 546 was generated as we began to look at those my age. I'm the leading edge of the baby boomers. We get back into riding. I'm a 40-year rider myself, and they get back into riding. Maybe they haven't ridden for some time. They can now afford a new motorcycle, be it a sport bike, a Harley Davidson, and they get out and they start riding. They can get an endorsement by going down and taking a test. It's a guy thing. A lot of us don't think that we need to be retrained for something that we did in our 20s. Not the case, we see a disproportionate amount of deaths and accidents that occur with the older rider. Now, understanding this background, Senate Bill 546 was signed into law to cause this progressive training for new endorsees. Now, as to Senate Bill 133 itself, it had some unintended consequences, and for that I apologize to the committee, because I was a part of the discussions on 133 and on 546 when it went through. In that, there is a small cadre of motorcyclists. It's usually around 25. I don't think there's any year that's been more than 30, who want to become licensed and endorsed to ride a three-wheel motorcycle only, sidecar, three-wheel. You see in your color picture there several different configurations. These handle quite a bit differently. They have a slightly different testing procedure with ODOT, and as they go through this testing, and I have gone through that myself just to understand it with some of them, they can get their test. Unfortunately, 546 requires that even these people go through motorcycle education as it's phased in. This will be an extreme expense to the state of Oregon. It will cause the need to develop a new curriculum. Mr. Hahn will probably address that a little bit more than myself. It'll require a larger range to train on. If we are to supply motorcycles for three-wheeled motorcycles for people to train on, that will be a huge expense, whereas the current training motorcycles that people can ride on cost less than $3,000. It easily goes north of $20,000 for a three-wheel motorcycle. They're extremely expensive. I would like to suggest that Senate Bill 133 is good public policy. It has the potential to avert very high expenditures of public taxpayer dollars to proceed with training and motorcyclist dollars, because frankly most of the training is funded from motorcycle endorsement fees. It in no way impinges upon the Oregon Department of Transportation and Oregon Department of Motor Vehicles' ability to test both knowledge test and riding skills so people can get their license. And I would like to just stand, the committee stand in support of Senate Bill 133. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Thank you. We'll finish with the panel and then two questions.
Okay.
Ron.
Okay. Co-Chair Vence, Co-Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Pat Hahn. I represent Team Oregon Motorcycle Safety Program. I live 1225 Grant Avenue Northwest in Corvallis. And I'm here and I've provided written testimony as such that Team Oregon supports Senate Bill 133. We think it's a good idea. We are the program responsible for training the riders in Oregon who are required to take motorcycle training. Our two-wheel courses are the only curricula in Oregon that meet ODOT requirements for the training, the mandatory training. We provide
motorcycles, two-wheeled motorcycles, to the students that take our training courses. However, we do not provide three-wheelers. Our curricula, our range layouts, and our riding exercises do not accommodate three-wheeled vehicles. So there's the cost to develop a curriculum and deploy it statewide for the riders of three-wheeled bikes would be prohibitive. The other thing that we need to talk about is that the riders of three-wheelers have not been identified as a significant highway safety problem. I think we've heard a little bit of this already, but of the 230 motorcycle fatalities over the past 5 years, only one had been riding a three-wheeled vehicle. And that person was also, he was a fully endorsed motorcyclist. He didn't have the three-wheel restriction. Of 3,139 motorcycle injuries between 2004 and 2008, there were 105 that were incurred on a three-wheel vehicle. Okay, so that's 3.3%. The one of 230 motorcycle fatalities, that amounts to about 0.4%. And like Van suggested, motorcycle riders who are restricted to three wheels only, they have a motorcycle endorsement but a three-wheel-only restriction on them, there are a total of 220 of them, give or take one or two, in the state right now. And that's out of 220,000-plus licensed riders. So we're talking the audience is about 0.1% of the motorcycle riding population. Team Oregon supports this bill, and I would welcome any questions that anyone has. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, and we'll listen to our last member of our panel, Mr. Quiet.
Thank you. Co-Chair Benz, Co-Chair Reed, members of the committee. The only problem, I'm representing quite a few organizations today.
We need your name for the record.
Quiet.
And that, and it's just spelled like we have it here. So.
Q-U-I-E-T.
Great, thank you.
I represent the Oregon Confederation of Motorcycle Clubs, Abate of Oregon, Bike Pack of Oregon, and Motorcycle Riders Foundation today. The only problem we have is the safety issue and the motorcycle issue. Motorcycles will still be defined as having three wheels or less. What we seek, right, I'll read the statute. It's under Title 51, ORS 801.365, I'll just go directly to 3, is designed to travel with not more than three wheels in contact with the ground. Mr. Moore gave me a piece of information earlier that this is being addressed on a federal level. But what we would like to see for the state of Oregon to remove one word in that number 3, and that would be two wheels in contact with the ground.
Thank you. Let's start with questions for this panel and Co-Chair Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate particularly hearing the number of if I got my notes right here, the number of folks who have three-wheel motorcycles, 220 out of 220,000. Sounds like a pretty small number, but I wonder if you could talk about what your plans would be if that number jumps up. Sounds like at some point it would be a significant enough number to justify some specific training. I don't know enough about motorcycles to know the physics and what's different, but I'm wondering if there are specific sorts of training that would make sense once the number reaches a sufficient quantity and what you might think about that.
Co-Chair Reed, Co-Chair Benz, members of the committee, we don't have a plan in place now if that becomes an eventuality. There are three-wheeled training programs that do exist in the country. None of them are currently approved by ODOT for the rider training requirement, but it would involve, at least on our level, it would involve research and development of a new training curricula, testing it, training instructors, buying bikes, securing or modifying the land to run the courses, things like that. It would be a pretty involved process that would take 1 to 2 years. A rough ballpark estimate would be $250,000 to $750,000 per year for up to 2 years, but we haven't tried it yet, so that's a wild guess.
Okay, thanks. Follow up,
please.
Could you hazard any guess as to what number in your judgment would be sufficient to justify that effort, and is there any Anything you could share about if there's growth in the sales of these machines?
Yeah, Co-Chair Reed, Co-Chair Benz, there has been an increased popularity of three-wheel motorcycles since fellows like Van have decided to get back into riding. One of the issues is that people either they cannot or they don't care to try to hold up a motorcycle when they come to a stop, for example. So as you can see by the photos that, that Van provided you, they are becoming more popular, and they're definitely growing. Oh, and that was the second part of the question. What was the first part?
First was what you think the right number might be to justify the effort and expense.
You know, that would be a better question for our friends at ODOT. I don't know at what level, say, a fatality rate becomes statistically significant. Maybe that's, maybe it's 3% of the fatalities, maybe it's 5, 10, I don't know, but it would have to reach a level that a statistician would say that is a statistically significant number. It needs a countermeasure.
Thank you. Further questions?
Just ahead.
Mr. Chair, looks like...
Oh, yes.
Can I respond on that a little?
Please move the microphone over to about a foot away from
just there. Just a little bit more. Why this whole thing started with me is somebody called me up and goes, hey, there's a commercial on TV that says, come ride one of our Can-Am three-wheelers and get your motorcycle endorsement, which is totally untrue. You can get a J restriction, but this is how this whole thing got started with me. They're advertising on television that you can get a motorcycle endorsement by purchasing one of their three-wheel vehicles, by taking the test on one of their vehicles. And this, the Can-Am is two wheels in front and one in back.
I think I understand the issue. Let's, I mean, that's a nice, very nice way of putting it. I'm going to go back for just a moment to the question of why at all a motorcycle endorsement. So I can have a, I have my motorcycle, I got it years ago. What is it that worries people about a motorcycle, so I can in turn see why we should or shouldn't worry about the same things with a three-wheel device?
Okay, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Okay, well,
sorry.
So we have to do get a motorcycle endorsement even though we might have a driver's license. So there must be some reason we think folks that ride motorcycles need to be trained. And by the way, I've heard great things about the Team Oregon program. I mean, I've heard some really good things. But my question is, there must be a reason, there must be some dangerous elements of a motorcycle that require this additional endorsement. What are those, and are any of those also present when you talk about a three-wheel device? I hate to refer to it as a motorcycle.
Okay, I think I understand your question. Co-Chair Benz, Co-Chair Reed, here's what I know about it. There are two things that we're looking at here. There's the stability of the motorcycle, and then there's the vulnerability of the motorcyclist. And in the case of either a two-wheel motorcycle or a three-wheel motorcycle, those riders are both vulnerable in crashes, relatively speaking, compared to drivers of four-wheel vehicles with the airbags and the bumpers and the crash cage and everything like that. Motorcycle, the reason the endorsement exists, and it's an additional test that they have to take above and beyond the test for the driver's license, is because a motorcycle, particularly a two-wheeled vehicle, requires some special skills to ride. There are techniques and skills required that are not intuitive. Often they can't be discovered without being trained or having someone show you how to do that. Sometimes people can luck into it and figure it out on their own, maybe by reading a book. But there are skills that are involved in steering the thing efficiently and braking efficiently and understanding.
As you're going through each one of those, you can say, and it would apply to the three-wheel, or you can tell me it doesn't, as you're going through that little list.
Okay. Well, let's look at the Department of Motor Vehicles. The test that they give, generally, nationwide speaking, they're going to test them on swerving. Okay, a motorcycle requires a special technique to swerve in a case of emergency, and the technique is completely different on a three-wheel vehicle. It's the three-wheel vehicle steers more like a car, so it doesn't apply to three-wheelers.
Well, and then the safety feature. So I guess if I knew how to drive a car, I wouldn't need the additional training for the three-wheel device. Is that what I just heard, or is it just a different type of danger?
That's a pretty succinct summary of it,
okay.
Yeah.
And then the next one.
for being?
So after steering, then there would be braking, emergency braking, and the techniques are similar but different because of the way the vehicle is constructed and designed. So they both require some additional technique above and beyond that of being able to drive a car, although the techniques are different from a three-wheeler to a two-wheel vehicle. Another, what else do we test on? There'll be basic low-speed balance and control. A motorcycle is a heavy machine. You know, you see on the prescription bottle, do not operate heavy machinery. A motorcycle is a heavy machine. And so balancing it at slow speeds and maneuvering in tight turns and things like that takes a tremendous amount of skill and a few techniques that are not required on a three-wheeler at all because they balance themselves. They don't tip over unless you do something dramatically wrong. And then I'm trying to think of what other and cornering is another example of special techniques required for motorcycles that are more or less not required as much for three-wheeled vehicles because they steer more like a car. It's a matter of keeping the thing on the road. Motorcycles require something called counter-steering, which is steering in the opposite direction of the direction you want to go in order to get the bike to lean and things like that. There's throttle control and things like that to stabilize the suspension front and rear, and none of those things really come into play when you're cornering a three-wheeler. So of those four main categories, maybe one, the braking has a lot of similarities to two-wheel motorcycles, but other than that, unless Van can think of something that I'm not thinking of right now, or Quiet can, I'm sure he's got plenty to say on it. I think one of the four skills needed is probably similar. Otherwise, the other three are pretty different.
Chair Vince, Chair Reed, I would concur with that, except to underscore a little bit more. One, the braking issue is probably farther apart than one might imagine. Proper technique in stopping a motorcycle on asphalt, you rely much more heavily on the front brake. With a three-wheel, especially the Can-Am Spyder, has no front brake. It does, but it's linked. There's a brake pedal. There's no brake lever. Found that out the first time I rode one. I was told, now, when you ride this thing, you're going to feel yourself reaching for that brake lever. It's not going to be there. They were right. In fact, the story was I went to the Department of Motor Vehicles to help them lay out a course for testing this new Can-Am Spyder. Steve Garrett's from Team Oregon, a very experienced rider. He rode it, worked the cones down to where they thought that that someone that was new to a Can-Am could ride the test. They then picked me as a guinea pig. I'm a Goldwing rider. I can do the motorcycle test on a Goldwing. I have no problem weaving those cones on a 900-pound motorcycle. They told me to ride the Can-Am for about the same distance as it would take me to get to the Portland Road location where they sell them, and to kind of duplicate that. So I would be a new rider that had just purchased a Can-Am. I rode straight down to DMV when it was there on the corner of Silverton Road and Highway 99, and proceeded to take the test. You know, I did okay for most of it because I listened to what I'd been told. But the steering part, slow speed steering, there's no balance problems. You can just kind of creep along. It's more like riding a trials motorcycle. Stopping is more like riding a dirt bike in the dirt. You rely on the rear brake, and same thing with a trike. When it came to critical steering, high speed steering, I found out when I was cornering on my little jaunt that it tends to throw you to the outside of the motorcycle because it doesn't lean at all. It's more like riding a quad, an off-road quad. It wants to throw you out, the centripetal force. And then when I went to do the swerve test on the Can-Am, I saw Steve smiling at me, and I charged up, I hit the barrier, I swerved, and instinctively I countersteered. It just about launched me. I had to go back and retaste that segment of the test. And I'm an experienced rider. It is a completely different animal. It's more stable if you're restricting your riding only to three wheels. It's a more stable vehicle, inherently safer if you're on gravel, if you hit a gravel patch on a corner, if you're on adverse, it's wet roads and stuff. It is inherently safer than two wheels. Two wheels take special training to be able to handle adverse conditions. They're vastly different animals, vastly different, you know, and hence one of the reasons that National Highway Transportation Authority is looking at the definition on a national basis. It is an issue.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. That answers the question very, very, very adequate. I really appreciate it. Nothing to add? Further questions for this group? Very quiet for Friday afternoon. Mr. Kreis, did you have something to say?
No, you said quiet.
Sorry. We're just waiting. Yeah. On that note, thank you very much. And I
thanks.
Thank you. Anyone else signed up for this? I don't think I'm ready to work the bill. Mr. Chair, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 133, and we will move to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 142. Zach.
Senate Bill 142 revises regulation of water utilities by the PUC.
Mr. Chair, any idea why this bill is in our committee?
I have no idea.
Economic Development and Water Committee.
Yes.
Smarter people are on this committee
now. Let's see. 142. Here we go. Mark.
Good afternoon, Chair Benson, Chair Reed, and members of the committee. I'm Mark Hellman of the Public Utility Commission. Senate Bill 142 clarifies our statutes with respect to water utilities and is primarily housekeeping in nature and does not change the intent of our statutes and has no known opposition. It was passed unanimously by the Senate. There is one change that's not housekeeping, and that is to increase the threshold by which service regulation is triggered, and it increases the rate from $18 per month to $24 a month for an average residential customer. This all came about when we were looking at our rules and revising our rules and looked at the statutes and realized that the statutes didn't mesh well together. And so this legislation is to revise it and to make it sensible and consistent. And I'm available for any questions.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So I have some concern that is... that is amorphous, which is the exercise of recognizing that our laws are problematic and don't match with our implementation of them. And therefore, the thing that we change is not our implementation, but is the law. And then we call that a housekeeping bill makes me, at first blush and knee-jerk, somewhat nervous. What sort of input have we received, and might there be in this room, from across the spectrum stakeholders, both, water advocates from different portions of the water debate, on this bill?
Co-Chair Benson, Co-Chair Reed, we ran the legislation by our major stakeholders, and they supported these changes. The changes that we looked at were essentially where we had some utilities that weren't required to file rates, and yet they had to charge the rates that were on file. I mean, the way the legislation had it before just led to situations that didn't make sense. And so the proposed legislation that we have here makes it so that the statutes are actually sensible.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So when you say your major stakeholders, if we could, and I don't know the Chair's desire, I for my part, wouldn't be ready to support the bill today, would want to hear more. is there, can we look at a list of the folks who have, you know, offered meaningful input or said, oh yeah, this is nothing, it's all good doing, and does that include both, I presume it includes, hope it includes sort of major ratepayer interests and those sort of stakeholders. I hope it would also include consumer groups and public interest stakeholders, which hold a different stake but might provide an interesting optic through which to view.
Co-chairs Benz and Reed, I can provide you with a list of who we contacted on the statutes.
Great.
This change.
Great, thanks.
Representative Wainer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just going through this, and why do we need to bump the rate from 18 to 24? That's roughly, what, 25% increase?
Co-chairs Benson and Reed, what the 18 to 24, it is a significant increase, and what that does, it makes it less likely that a water utility would fall under service regulations. Right now, if they charge an average rate below 18 and everything's fine, they're not service regulated. If we kept it at that, as inflation goes along and their costs go up and they need to raise their rates, they would more likely fall under our regulations. So to take inflation and things into account, we propose raising it to 24, and that allows them to charge just under $24 a month and not come under commission jurisdiction.
So, because it's dealing with 500 customers or fewer, may I follow up?
Yes.
Sorry. My guess follow-up would be, these are small communities that we're dealing with here. So it looks like for customers, if they go above that, they'll fall under regulation. What kind of regulation would they fall under at that point if they go above that $18 or $24? Because would it be something we may want to regulate them for?
Co-chairs Benz and Reed, what they would fall under is service regulations, so we would not be responsible for reviewing their rates and all that. But as far as they're dealing with customers and that kind of operating practices, those kinds of things, they would need to follow so that they have responsible service to their customers as far as dealing with issues.
So if we bump it and they stay below it, then they can have irresponsible service to their customers without being under any authority.
Co-chairs Benson Reed, if a small water utility that's charging less than 24, if they are providing poor or inadequate service, customers contact us, and after review those and doing an investigation, they would fall under service regulation. So companies that are providing fine service and are charging less than 24, we have really no dealings with them. It's only when they provide inadequate service.
Further questions? Service regulation, can you just give us an extremely succinct definition of that? Service regulation.
Co-Chair Benson Reed, so service regulation might be disconnect, connection kinds of rules, things of that nature.
The reason I ask it, I'm just curious to follow up on Representative Widener's questions. If there was a problem and a group of the customers did sign the petition 20% to ask for help, is the help simply going to be rate regulation, or is there something beyond just rates that the PUC would address?
Co-Chair Benson Reed, so for a small company where customers are petitioning, then in that case they're petitioning for rate regulation, and rate regulation includes service regulation, and there's nothing more than that.
It's not a situation where the PUC steps in, takes over, and operates the thing. It's merely a regulatory involvement. You can't charge more than this. You can't charge as much as you've been charging. I mean, you can't discriminate. I'm just trying to figure out what it is the PUC actually does when it steps in.
Co-chairs Benson Reed. So when the commission is regulating a water company, so that has to do with the rates, just like a major utility where the rates need to be just and reasonable, the same as for water companies as well. The situation you're talking about or mentioned about taking over a water company, that is under or is referred to as appointing a regent. And in my experience, which has been fairly lengthy at the PUC, that's only happened twice. One is fairly recent, where customers were in significant dire straits with their water company.
But the PUC has that power, just not often is it exercised. Is that the proper way to say it?
Yes.
Thank you. Are there further questions? See none. Thank you very much. Dr. Smith, I don't think there's any problem holding this over if you want to wait for the material.
That'd be great.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Okay with you,
mm-hmm.
Chair Reed. All right, with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 142 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 534A. Zach.
Senate Bill 534A requires an independent appraisal of physical damage to a motor vehicle for insurance purposes to be conducted by a person who has been issued a vehicle appraiser certificate for license.
Do we have someone signed up?
Mr. Darrell Fuller.
The last person in the room. What's this say about our next bill?
It's that it's also his.
Yeah. Could be.
Oh, so it is.
It's a twofer day for me. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Auto Appraisers of Oregon. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 534, which makes a couple of really small changes and has the support, or at least lacks opposition from the insurance industry, which is where the statute has changed. People who appraise automobiles in the state of Oregon now are required, and have been since, I believe, 2007, are required to be certified by DMV as a vehicle appraiser. The first change that Senate Bill 534A makes, and all the changes that it makes are within the insurance statute, specifically in a case where a insured driver is uncomfortable with the amount of money that the insurance company is offering to total their vehicle. And so the insured, if that policy provides for it, can ask for an independent appraiser to do an appraisal of the total vehicle to find out whether or not the insurance company's offer is a reasonable offer or not. So we're talking about a third party coming into this dispute between the insurer and the insured to make sure that that number is accurate. And a problem that we're trying to avoid is a situation where the vehicle that is insured is a specialty type of vehicle, say a hot rod or a large commercial vehicle, and not all appraisers are competent to appraise that type of vehicle. If you have a Model T, or if you have a hot rod, or you know a souped up vehicle of some kind, or if you have a dump truck, for example, just because you're certified as an appraiser doesn't necessarily mean that you have the experience necessary to appraise that type of vehicle. So what we're inserting into the insurance language that already says that the person has to be disinterested, in other words, that the person offering that third-party appraisal can't have a relationship or be a party to either of the sides that are in dispute, we want to add the word competent in there as well, which means that the person has to have a background or be competent to appraise the type of vehicle that is insured in that situation. The second change that we make is really sort of a housekeeping change, and that is the statute that requires people to be certified by DMV in order to appraise vehicles, of course, is in Department of Transportation statutes. And so we're simply including that requirement by reference here in the insurance statute so that people are looking at the insurance statutes are aware of the fact that they have to have an appraiser's license in order to do business in the state of Oregon, or they have to be licensed in another jurisdiction. We're not preventing them from hiring an appraiser from Vancouver or using an appraiser from another state. It's just that if an appraisal is going to be done in the state of Oregon, we require those people to be licensed. So a couple of small changes. Again, I ran this by the insurance lobby and talked to them prior to it getting out on the Senate side, made some tweaks, and I don't anticipate, well, the room's empty. There doesn't appear to be any opposition to the bill. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Questions? Yes, Mr. Weiner.
Zach has one too, maybe. Okay.
I got one I'll get to at the end that I talked with Representative Smith about, but been through a couple wrecks. Right now, the insurance company has their appraiser, and you have your right to an appraiser, and then if there's any disagreement, then a third-party appraiser comes in and looks at it as well. Correct?
Co-chairs and Representative Widener, if your car is totaled, of course, you have the right to hire an appraiser if you want to. Whether that independent appraiser that you hire is going to have any impact on what the insurance company wants to do is up to the insurance company. The specifics that we're talking about in this legislation is if the policy that the insurance that you have with your insurance company, or if the policy of the person who hits you, if that policy provides that if you dispute the amount of money that the insurance company is offering you for your total vehicle, that you can request a third-party appraiser that they pay for, not you, okay, that third-party appraiser that's called for under the insurance policy would be this independent third-party appraiser, and that they would have to be licensed. Now, you could still dispute that other person and hire as many appraisers as you want to as an individual. This is specific to within an insurance policy that has a provision. So I mean, it's a very, very narrow change that has a provision which permits the insured, to request that the insurance company hire a independent appraiser to verify the number because they're not happy with that number.
Hello. I just went through this process, actually. My wife totaled her car, so.
I did in September. Somebody rear-ended me and totaled mine, so we're in the same boat.
Yeah, and the insurance company that we had came back with appraisals that I felt weren't appropriate. Then I had a third-party appraiser that I had contacted come in and give results, and at that point we're able to agree with it. But at that point I could have had them hire a third-party appraiser myself and went and arbitrated the value.
Co-chairs and Representative Widener, I mean, that may be correct. The part of the, and this is existing statute, if you look at the bill on lines, I think 6, 7, and 8, we're talking about if the policy, this is on line 6, second half of the sentence, if the policy contains a provision authorizing the insured to obtain an independent appraisal by a competent and disinterested person. So again, this is the only change this is going to make in terms of statute is in if the policy that you have with your insurance company already calls for that independent appraiser to be hired. Okay, then we're regulating who that person is that they hire. You as a consumer, as an individual with a wrecked car, you can hire anybody you want to appraise your vehicle. There's no regulation on you as an individual. This simply regulates into the circumstances where you're within an insurance policy that calls for it. Within that insurance provision, we're adding a requirement that the person that is hired by the insurance company as an independent appraiser be licensed either here or out of another state, and that the person, our statute already says they have to be disinterested, and then we're adding the word competent, so that as a consumer who has that provision in their insurance policy, that you know that the person that they're going to hire is competent to appraise the type of vehicle you have if you happen to be driving around in your 67 Mustang and want somebody that's competent to appraise a vehicle because it's a souped-up specialty vehicle and not just a 2000 LHS or whatever.
Further questions? Yes. Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would the fact that we're causing insurance companies to use this licensed appraiser at this stage, would that prevent the number of claims like Representative Widener's claim? I assume that's like a diminished value thing or something where there's a dispute and that that you're trying to prove that your car is worth more than the insurance company. If the insurance company says, well, we have this licensed appraiser that did it, is that going to cut down on those claims?
Co-chairs, Representative Sheehan, I don't know the answer to that question. It has been a statute in Oregon, I think, since 2007, that you're required to have an appraiser certificate in the state of Oregon to appraise a vehicle as part of your business, and there are exceptions for car dealers and people that already appraise vehicles. But if you're appraising vehicles specifically to earn income, you're already required by state law to have an appraiser's certificate. The issue we're trying to address by adding that by reference in this statute is that not everybody's aware of that because the appraisal certification requirements are in DMV statutes where we require people to have a certificate to sell cars, to tow a tow truck, to be an appraiser. All of those statutes are in here. Since we had a bill where we were sort of making a tweak to insurance law, it made sense to us to add a reference into the insurance laws dealing with appraisers that we simply mention in there, by the way, you have to be certified in the state of Oregon to offer an appraiser. Just makes it more likely that people that may not be aware, if it's an insurance company out of New York that's trying to hire somebody and they're figuring out who they're going to hire in the state of Oregon, that more likely that they're going to see that you're required to be certified in the state of Oregon because you're not required to be certified in all states. And so we're just, by adding it by reference here, we're just trying to do some education within the insurance industry that Oregon does have a requirement that you have a certification in the state of Oregon in order to appraise vehicles, or the person from out of state has to have a certification as well.
A quick follow-up. And I notice on lines 10 and 11, it talks about the vehicle appraiser certificate or license by another state or government body. Can you describe what the difference between our vehicle appraiser certificates and what a license might be? It sounds like we don't have a license. We have a certificate in Oregon.
Co-chairs and Representative Sheehan, I can't. Amy Joyce from DMV might be here, might be able to add. Sorry, Amy. She might better. I don't understand why in some cases we license and in some cases we certify, because everybody talks about how they have a motor vehicle dealer certificate, and that's a license, but they use the terms interchangeably. I have a license to sell cars, or I have a license. I'm a licensed auto appraiser. But when you tell DMV folks, well, you know, I want to get my vehicle certificate, my appraiser's license, they say, well, we don't issue a license, we issue a certificate. And I'm not sure the nuance between the two of those, frankly. But it is it's a certification. It's the same way with dismantlers, with auto dealers, with most of what DMV does, but they issue us a driver's license, not a driving certificate. So there's obviously a distinction of some kind between the two, but to be honest with you, I don't know what that is.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I guess my concern would be when we sort of change words around of, you know, what certification somebody has or license somebody has. I guess I'll dumb it down to a really blunt question of who is this going to put out of work, who's going to get more business as a result of this legislation, who's this going to hurt and help, I guess.
Co-chairs, Representative Sheehan, again, it shouldn't put anybody out of work. People that are appraising vehicles in Oregon for a living have been living under a licensing a certification requirement since 2007. So this doesn't change that at all. It simply mentions it by reference in the insurance statutes. So this is not changing or adding any regulation or requirement. Even if that section of the bill were to be removed and we didn't mention it by reference here, they would still be required to use a certified appraiser in the state of Oregon legally, because in the state of Oregon you're required under whatever the statutory reference is there, 819480, you're already required to have an appraiser's certificate. So this doesn't add any regulation on certified appraisers or on the appraising business in Oregon. This simply mentions that the regulation already exists in this statute. So it shouldn't put anybody out of business. It shouldn't impact. The only people it would potentially impact would be if there are people in the state of Oregon who are appraising vehicles now who do not have a certification. Okay, they are currently operating in violation of the law, and we want to get those people to be certified. And we want to make sure that everybody that's doing that is certified in the state of Oregon, because, like I said, it's been the requirement since 2007.
And the other state or government body, does that factor into competition or anything that's a new thing?
Co-chairs and Representative Sheehan, we didn't want to be in a position where we were telling insurance companies from out of state that if a vehicle was totaled in the state of Oregon, they had to hire an Oregon appraiser or it wasn't going to be good enough for us. It's a reciprocity issue. We don't want to get into a battle with somebody who wants to hire an appraiser who had a long-time relationship with an appraiser in Vancouver that they would no longer be able to appraise vehicles in the state of Oregon unless they came and got one of our licenses, too. Our belief is that if they have a license or a certification as an appraiser in another state, we're making the assumption that they're all going to be relatively the same in terms of what the requirements are, and if it's good enough for their state, we'll consider it good enough for us.
Thank you.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Winder.
Real quick, because we're running this long. Are you any relation to Matt Wand?
Representative Widener, co-chair, is no, and I understand he changed his hair specifically to make that less likely.
Okay.
I noticed the same thing.
Yeah.
It was brought to my attention from Representative Smith.
Oh, why'd you guy call me out like that?
ORS 819480, I did not bring my computer, so I can't go back and look at exactly whether that did apply to this statute by virtue of the use of the description independent appraisal, or just by the use of the word appraisal. I'm wondering if that has to be if this doesn't indeed ratchet up certainly ratchets up the quality of the people because you put the word competent in. But what's the story on the on my question? I guess 819480, because it doesn't look to me as though it was in here, and that's why it's now being put here. Let me put a finer point on the question. Before, if we don't adopt this language, could someone who is not certified act under 742-4661?
Co-Chair Benz, my answer to that question would be no, not within the confines of the current statutes. I have 819-480 with me, and actually the operative language is an 819-482. 480 is the licensing. 482 is the acting portion of the statute. It says a person commits the offense of acting as a vehicle appraiser without a certificate if the person does not hold a vehicle appraiser certificate issued under 819-480, and the person, for consideration, issues an opinion as to the value of the vehicle. So regardless of whether it's inside the insurance purposes or whether it's for any other purpose, you have to have a certificate in the state of Oregon in order to render an opinion on the value of the vehicle for consideration or for pay. There are some exceptions in 482, again, vehicle dealers, because they're doing trade-ins all the time. We've added all of the disclaimers that people wanted for people that are doing other kinds of business.
But not this particular activity. It's not an exception.
Insurance adjusters in sub C of 482 and insurance adjuster themselves are exempt. So if you're working for an insurance company as an adjuster, you're not required to have a certification. But if you are being hired as an independent appraiser by an insurance company, you're not their employee, you're coming in to provide a third party disinterested, and again the statute, the insurance language has that word disinterested in there. We're looking for somebody who's not connected to the insurance industry at this point, who can provide a third party opinion to validate or invalidate what the insurance company is offering the third party provider, and that person, regardless of whether this bill passes or not, is still required under 482 and 480 to have a certification in the state of Oregon or to be certified or license in another state.
Let's go to the competent word then. The word competence is subject to an awful lot of interpretation. And so the merely placing that word in the statute doesn't seem to me to maybe get you where you want to go, unless you have some other frame of reference within which you think that word would operate.
Mr. Chair, my understanding in talking both to my clients and to the insurance industry is that word competent used in this context is a well-grounded word in insurance law, in insurance policies, and in insurance regulations. That if you were to grab the book of common insurance terms that is used in that industry, that this is a word that already has a well-known definition inside of the insurance industry.
One of our colleagues has asked that we not move this bill today, so that would give you time to provide me with that definition. That would be very helpful if you're
happy to do that.
Are there further questions for our lone panelist? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 534A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 958. Zach.
Senate Bill 958 defines mobile motor vehicle crusher and crushed motor vehicle. It also establishes requirements for both of those.
And our witness, Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Northwest Auto Trades Association. NATA represents collision and mechanical repair shops, dismantlers, auto dealers, towers, anybody that's involved in the auto industry. Senate Bill 958 comes out of a work group that came out of DMV business regulations, because there are businesses that have vehicle crushers. These are the machines that turn cars into little square metal boxes that then are used to that are recycled as scrap metal. And some of those some of those crushers are mobile. They're set on trucks and they can go from location to location. And mobile crushers are not defined in statute, so DMV was sort of put into a box in terms of trying to make sure that they were properly regulated. And so the results of the work group was to define what a mobile crusher is and then to make specify in statutes a framework in which they can be regulated. What we've done in Section 1 is in Section 1 is slightly different than the mobile crusher part. Section 1, the federal government requires anybody who dismantles vehicles to register with the federal government to make sure that that VIN number, when they crush a car, that that VIN number is killed, if you will. And so we want to make sure that everybody who is a dismantler in the state of Oregon is registering with the federal government through the National Motor Vehicle Title Information System. So Section 1 of the bill simply requires them to provide that number on their application for a dismantler certification or for a renewal. And that just ensures that we have that number on record and that they're following the federal statute. The second change in Section 2 has to do with defining a mobile motor vehicle crushers and making sure we can identify, if we find a mobile motor vehicle crusher, who it belongs to, by ensuring that they have their name on it and that they're a certified dismantler. If you have a mobile crushing unit, you're going to use it in one of two places. You're going to go to smaller dismantlers who can't afford their own crushing unit, and you're going to crush vehicles for them as a subcontractor. In that case, the property is already licensed as a or certified as a dismantling facility, and so in that case, since it is the on-site dismantler that owns the vehicles and is subcontracting with the mobile dismantler, we specify in statute that the on-site dismantler who owns the vehicle is responsible for making sure that all the rules and regulations regarding dismantling are followed by their subcontractor. That is to ensure that the oil has been taken out of the vehicle, the mercury switches are taken out of the vehicle, the airbag has been exploded or taken out, so that we don't have a problem with any environmental concerns when the vehicle's crushed with something getting into the groundwater or into the ground. Mobile crushers are also called into non-licensed locations, sometimes by DEQ or by cities and counties. If they go to a property, a rural property, for example, where somebody's been collecting cars for too long and it's become a hazard and they want to remove all the vehicles from that farm property or that rural property, local government or DEQ may call in a mobile crusher to crush the vehicles to make them easier to move out of that property, because you can fit a whole lot more crushed vehicles on the back of a truck than you can vehicles that are still whole. In those cases, if you have a mobile crusher coming to a location that is not a licensed dismantler facility, then that mobile crusher, that also is required by statute to be licensed as a dismantler, will be required to follow all the dismantling rules prior to crushing the vehicles on that non-licensed property. And we also specify that they can only be there for a limited amount of time, because we don't want somebody setting up a second dismantler operation at a non-licensed facility. There's already a provision in statute that if you have a dismantler certification and you want to open up a second location, you can get a supplemental certificate without having to get a new license or a new certification. And if you're going to have a second permanent location, we want them to have that supplemental certificate. But if they're only going to be there for 4 or 5 days dismantling a small number of vehicles, like I said, on a rural property or farm or someplace, we don't want them to have to go through the process, and DMV doesn't want them to go through the process of getting a supplemental certificate for what's going to be a very temporary location. And then the last section, in sections 3 through 5, DMV was having some difficulty in that the way the dismantler statutes are currently constructed, depending on the type of violation the dismantler did, the DMV's ability to levy a penalty or to somehow penalize a dismantler was based on what that statute was. And what we've done in the last couple of sections is we've cross-referenced everything. And this gives DMV the ability to choose which kind of penalty is appropriate for whatever violation or the number of violations they had. So, for example, if you had done X wrong before, the only thing DMV could do was suspend your license. They couldn't give you a monetary fine. But if you were to do X and Y wrong, all they could do is give you a monetary fine. They weren't allowed to suspend your license. And DMV wanted, and frankly, the industry that supports having a well-regulated environment, a safe and a level playing field, we want DMV to have that flexibility to pick and choose sort of the penalty that they think is appropriate for the violation. So we've ensured that whatever the violation is among those statutes, that DMV has all of the arrows available to them in the quiver in terms of putting together a penalty. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Questions? Who's the we you're referring to?
The we would be, depending on when I was referring to it, would be the Northwest Auto Trades Association, which is the association I represent, which represents the dismantlers in the state of Oregon. The work group that we had, I may have been referring to we as a work group that we had with DMV that included dismantlers, mobile dismantlers, DEQ and DMV, and putting together the goals that we were looking for in the statute. So depending on when I was said we, it would probably be one of those two groups.
Who, if anybody would object to this, other than somebody that has a fly-by-night operation that wants to drive around and crush cars and then go somewhere else?
Chair Vance, I don't know of anybody that would object to it. It's kind of a
rephrase.
Yeah, it's not a big cudgel. I've always wanted to use the word cudgel when you've been in the committee with me. But I'm not aware of anybody that was aware. Schnitzer's Steel, who has a mobile crushing license, mentioned some concerns on the Senate side, and we met with them, and they concluded that they didn't have any problems with the bill, but they looked at it carefully because they had a couple of questions, but then resolved that they didn't have any opposition to the bill. So I'm not aware of anybody that's opposed to it.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just wanted to compliment Mr. Fuller on his amazing ability to summon the representation of Schnitzer merely by the mention of the name and have that person walk in the room at just the right moment. Well done.
Further comments, questions? Thank you very much. I think members of the committee will probably not work this bill today either, unless they have some enthusiasm for doing so, and I don't seem to see it at this particular moment. So,
general matter.
with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 958. And
maybe it's just because it's Friday. I mean, I'm it's like she's talking very fast, and I'm.
Zach, let's go through what we need to do. We're going to carry over Senate Bill 133. We're going to carry over Senate Bill 142. We're going to carry over Senate Bill 534A. And we're going to carry over Senate Bill 958. And is there anything else we need to do today? That, then, there. It's ordered that they're carried over, and with that, I'm going to adjourn our House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development.